Good afternoon. Today we have Dr. Christopher Larson, who is going to be speaking to us about direct primary care, information needed to start your practice. Dr. Larson, thank you very much for spending the time with us today to educate our members on direct primary care. So I'll turn the program over to you.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today to talk about this. I'm a zealot for this style of practice, so anytime I get a chance to talk with anyone, I'll probably end up boring them to tears, so hopefully I won't do that today. I am an osteopathic family physician in Austin, Texas. Prior to going to medical school, I have a degree in finance from University of Texas at Austin. Started my career by working in energy investment banking in Houston, and then moved over to trading natural gas options. And some things at that point in my life made me think about a different career path, and I ended up focusing on medicine. And then even within that time frame, had an advisor suggest osteopathic school because of my own personal philosophy, and it fit me hand in glove. And then have been lucky enough after a residency to find direct primary care, because I believe that it allows me to implement the osteopathic philosophy within primary care, which to me means trying to figure out the root cause of the disease and to treat the root cause of the disease. And beyond just osteopathic manipulative techniques, I think that also gets to the way that someone lives their life. And if you're going to affect the way that they live their life, I think that you need a sufficient amount of time to help educate them what the problem is and then potentially the path to reversing that. And direct primary care really does give you a lot of time to spend with and on your patients. And so I think it's a great model for osteopathic family physicians. And so I'm happy to be here to talk about it.
Okay, wonderful. So you have a very diverse background. And maybe you can share with us how long you've been practicing and what a day in the life of a DPC doc looks like.
Sure, yeah. So I have been, I had my direct primary care clinic open for about 4 years now. And the first couple of years, I continued to work at an urgent care that I had worked at prior to opening the clinic. And I would work there one or two nights a week and then maybe every other weekend so that I could, you know, continue to make a paycheck to basically pay for the direct primary care clinic before it was able to sustain itself. Currently, I have almost 800 employer-based clients and maybe about a third of that as private clients. And so, you know, a day in the life of direct primary care for me is great. I enjoy coming to work because I get to spend a lot of time with my patients. I'm here in the office from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And generally, I start seeing texts come into my phone from patients about 8:30 or 9. And then, you know, much like an insurance-based primary care clinic, you're probably going to see about 1% of your patient panel on a daily basis. So for me, that's going to be anywhere from about 6 to 10 patients per day. And then I have communication with my patients throughout the day through text or phone calls or emails, and I can even do video telemedicine with my patients. And so it's just an interesting mix where I get to see patients face-to-face and kind of take care of classical primary care needs, be it taking off a wart or a skin tag or sewing up a laceration or taking care of someone's diabetes by working with their medication management or discussing diet with them. And I can do that face-to-face or over the phone or via text. And in this model, I'm incentivized to do all those things, basically to do what's best for the patient. And then I get to go home, and every once in a while there'll be a text that comes in, and if it's, I don't think that it needs to be addressed at that time, I just leave it until the next day without answering it. Or if something needs to escalate, I'll potentially initiate a phone call with the patient to help them in that moment. And a lot of people are scared about being on call 24/7 for their patients, but usually what happens is the first time a patient comes into my office, I have a conversation with them to say, hey, I am on call for you, And let me tell you the way that the clinic works and the way that communication works. Basically, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, I don't care what your question is, hit me with it because I want to be involved. Anything that's after hours, my request is that you just hold that communication for something that's urgent or emergent. And for the most part, people are aware of this and they understand it after I explain it to them and they're cognizant of it. Every once in a while, I think someone maybe misunderstands the communication technology, and when they use, we use a Spruce Health app for communication, I think that they may think that it's email in the sense that it doesn't notify me when they send the message, but it does, and that's the only way that I can be on call for them. And so if they send something that's inappropriate, usually what I would do is just contact them the next day or the next business day and kind of re-explain how the communication works. And on an ongoing basis, I really don't have a problem. And we can kind of compare this or like what I might do after work to my primary care wife who's in an insurance-based clinic. And on an average day, she's probably going to spend another hour to 3 hours on her computer after she comes home from work. And I just don't have that many tasks outside of work to take care of for the day that I've just finished because I'm able to use a more efficient electronic medical record and I'm not seeing the volume of patients that she's seeing.
Okay, great. That's an interesting contrast there. What is the best way to get information about starting a practice?
You know, when I started this practice, there was really only a few lay articles out there for me to read to understand the model. At that point, QLiance was going strong, and there were some other models that I would call Robinhood. Basically, half of the practice was concierge, and the doctors used the revenue from that half to fund other people that couldn't afford the concierge fees and subsidize their memberships. And given the information that was out there combined with the fact that I have a business background, it allowed me to kind of create some pro formas, some financial models that allowed me to make some estimations of what an appropriate panel size would look like and how much to charge. And then I did, even after starting, I kind of changed my model. I had a very small copay and some other fees associated with things like phlebotomy that since that time I've removed to become what I think is more a purist DPC model these days. But these days there's also much more information out there to help people that are interested in direct primary care start their own clinic. You know, we've really lost a generation or two of primary care physicians that might be mentors to students and residents and showing them that you can own your own business and you can teach others how to do it and how simple it might be. You know, starting one of these practices and running them, basically what I tell people is if you can balance your own checkbook at home, and I'm not saying all doctors can, then you should be able to run this practice because it's about the same amount of work. But these days, if you want to get more information about this, I think that you could go look at the special interest group for DPC from the ACOFP. There's a website, dpcfrontier.com, that's hosted by a JD that's also a DPC doctor. And he's got a lot of information on there from a regulatory standpoint to just the basics of starting up a practice. Additionally, Atlas.md, which is an electronic medical record that's created specifically for direct primary care doctors. If you scroll to the bottom of their homepage, you can see the DPC curriculum, and that's kind of a summary of what they might suggest for people that are interested in direct primary care. In addition to that, you know, we're probably nearing 800 to 1,000 direct primary care clinics across the nation. So you can go to dpcfrontier.com and they have a mapper page where you can look at the map of where all of these people are. And I would say, you know, it's a very collegial environment in DPC right now. And so you could probably just call up someone that's close to you and ask to come by and have a conversation. And I think that you would find a very welcoming voice at the other end of that phone call who would be happy to teach you about direct primary care.
Okay, good. What are the costs of starting a DPC practice?
These are really dependent upon your desires, and that's what I think is one of the great things about this model. Meaning, when I started, I called McKesson and I said, hey, give me your list of the things that most people need to start a practice, and I just checked the box for all the things that I wanted. But compare that to other people that say, hey, I really want to put a whole lot of time and effort into this in order to shop and find the best value, just like, you know, I might if I were going to go buy a car or a washing machine. And so there are a lot of people that will go out there and buy used EKG machines off of eBay or medical tables from Craigslist that they might find from a local doctor that's either retiring or changing businesses or selling out. And so this can really be whatever you want it to be. I ended up spending about $15,000 on equipment to start my clinic, but I've heard of people kind of decreasing that to maybe the $2,000 to $3,000 range, and then even potentially putting off some purchases until you have a larger patient panel. So I think I spent maybe $2,000 or $3,000 on an EKG, Bluetooth, could fit in your pocket if you wanted to put it in your pocket. And so but you could also do the med mark that you would stick on a cart and maybe 5 or 10 years old from somebody else's practice and get that for, you know, pennies on the dollar of what I paid for mine. And so this really can be whatever you want it to be. But as far as all of the costs associated with starting a practice, the biggest costs are going to be your office space and then also any type of employees. And there are a lot of direct primary care doctors out there that start without any employees. They basically answer the phone calls, they take the vital signs, they give the injections, and the electronic medical records are set up to be relatively efficient so that you can do a lot of the kind of legwork of referrals and that type of thing yourself. They also, many of them will take care of communication and basically route communication to the EMR for you. And so I would spend time, depending on what your desires are and your risk tolerance from a financial standpoint, on trying to find the least expensive office space out there, and then the equipment, do what's best for you. If you want to just, you know, make this easy, you could call your local medical equipment supplier and just check the boxes to buy things new, or you could get online and find deals. As far as starting the business, you know, I would look around and find, you can go to direct primary care sites, look at how they set their site up. You can look at their contract. When I started, I basically took bits and pieces from existing direct primary care doctor's contract, created my own, and then took it to a healthcare lawyer who could basically just look over my shoulder at my work to minimize the amount that I was going to have to pay for a lawyer.
What are the costs of keeping a practice running?
Yeah, so like I said, the rent and paying for any payroll are going to be the two largest costs. My overhead, so basically all of my expenses before I pay myself, is around $9,000 to $10,000 per month. I know a lot of people that have decreased that drastically, and the way that they do that is they rent space from another specialist. It's interesting that I think in order to be able to place pins on Google Maps in different parts of the city, and therefore from an SEO standpoint, be able to appeal to a good number of people, I think a lot of specialists will basically have office space in different parts of the city and kind of on a daily basis move office to office. And so you might be able to find a specialist who 4 days out of the week is not even at the office and would be happy to rent you some space there. That's a really good way to reduce your overhead. And one of the doctors here in Austin has done that until he grew his panel to a size where he could afford to get his own office space. I bought mine off of that just because I wanted something that I could depend on. And honestly, I spent about 6 months looking for something that I could afford and wanted from a rent standpoint and just couldn't find anything. Beyond that, your assistant is going to be your next largest payment throughout the month. And there are a lot of doctors that start with no assistant. And so if you choose to do that, it's very viable up until you get to whatever number of patients where you feel like, hey, there's enough work that I need help, or I'm willing to take some of the revenue that's coming in and pay for someone to help me. Beyond that, we're just talking about business insurance, your medical malpractice, accessing the internet, electricity, telephone, janitorial services, and those kinds of things. And a lot of these things, you know, janitorial, you could do yourself if you want, or you hire that out. And so once again, this is a situation where those costs are variable and very dependent upon what you feel like you need. And then as far as paying these costs, most doctors, when they start their clinic, are either living on savings for a while or they're moonlighting. And when you moonlight, many doctors are using either urgent care or telemedicine to moonlight while they basically spend their days Monday through Friday at the clinic.
Okay. Very good. What software do DPC doctors use for their practice needs?
Most direct primary care doctors are using just a handful of EMRs. There are a few that are really focused on cash-based practices, those being Alation, Atlas MD, MDHQ. I think Dr. Chrono is another that some people are using. And then it's worth looking at each of those websites because they all have some variability in the functionality that they offer. And some of them you're going to have to go out and get other software to combine with what you have in order to do things like collect payments, communicate with the patient, that type of thing. So Alation is what I use, and I combine that with Spruce Health and Hint. Alation is the EMR. Hint Health does the payment collection, kind of the Netflix-style drawing off of their credit card or their bank account on a monthly basis. And then Spruce is the communication component, the secure texting, phone calls, and video telemedicine. Atlas MD combines a lot of those things in one. The payment is included within their electronic medical record, as is the texting and the phone call. And a lot of people really do like that. For my purposes, Alation was better. And then MDHQ is one that's been around for a while. Ben Daffin is the developer, and he's awesome. And you get really personal service with them. And I think that they're still kind of changing their EMR to fit the needs of the direct primary care class of doctor. And so I would suggest looking at their model as well. Other communication software beyond Spruce is Twine. And then, as I said, Atlas MD has their own communication app. And then from the membership standpoint, really all that I know of is both is either Hint or Atlas MD. Funny enough, I've been doing this long enough that I was actually contracted with a software that was doing gym membership collection because I started this before I had heard of Hint, and thank goodness that Hint came around because that was really difficult to use. And then other pieces of software that doctors use just to kind of make their day go a little bit more quickly and not have to take work home with them are things like Text Expander, where you could basically create what I call dot phrases. So you could write .PE for physical exam, and you've already told the software, hey, .PE means throw a normal physical exam in, you know, wherever I have the cursor, and so it decreases the amount of time that you have to spend either dictating or typing. Acuity Scheduling is a software that I use to basically allow the patient within parameters to schedule their own appointments, and then Intake Queue can also do some scheduling, and in addition, you could use that for forms that you might have patients fill out.
How much telemedicine do you use in your practice?
I guess that depends on how you define telemedicine. So to me, the original telemedicine are doctors using telephones, and we've all done that no matter what style practice we've been in and calling patients about labs or returning phone calls. But beyond that, I use texting and video teleconference. Most of the communication for me that's I think would be considered telemedicine is texting back and forth about lab results or new symptoms that a patient might have or, hey, what should I do with this? To kind of maybe initiate the relationship or strengthen the relationship or discuss some nuanced ideas. I would say, maybe less than texting, I'll have patient phone calls. And then even fewer times than that, I do video teleconferences. With the software that I use, I'm the only one that can initiate a video teleconference. The patient can't do that. And I'm mainly doing that when I need the patient to show me something, where the pain is, what they might do when they have pain, or if I want to show the patient something in that moment, meaning, hey, let me point to my body. You tell me, does it hurt right here? Or let me show you a physical therapy exercise that I want you to do. Watch my body as I do it on myself. But as far as my patient panel goes, I would say most of my communication with most patients is not face-to-face. Generally, I would say the older population, especially at the beginning of the relationship, prefers face-to-face communication. But even that group will many times kind of revert to telemedicine in some form or fashion over time.
Okay, interesting. I know that our listeners will be very interested in the next topic, which is how will a DPC doctor determine what prices to set?
Right. So back when I did this, I really put a lot of time and effort into, making some estimations on how many times a year someone's going to come in, how much time that they're going to use, and kind of backing my way into the panel size and how much I might need on average per patient per year to pay for both my overhead and pay my salary. And these days, the model has been proven in the sense of we kind of know that direct primary care doctors are going to tap out at about 600 to 800 people or patients as a panel size. And so you can use that number as an assumption and then work backwards from there to figure out both how much you might need to pay your overhead. You'll have to make some estimations there. And then also how much you're going to end up paying yourself. So really the information that you might need, and you can work from right to left or left to right, is how much you want to be paid, how much your overhead is, the average amount that you think that you will collect per patient per month, and the total panel size that you want to take care of. And so what I would say is just make an assumption on what might be the most important thing for you, and that's going to be different things for different people. If the most important thing is how much you get paid, start there. If the most important thing is how much your average patient is going to have to pay you per month, we'll start there and set that and then work back from there. But in general, the model kind of would suggest that, let me just run you through the equation. So you take your pay plus your overhead, and then I would multiply that sum by 1.15, basically just to gross up the amount for anything that you may have overlooked, and then divide that by the total number of patients that you estimate you might have in your panel, and that's going to give you the kind of total amount that you need per patient per year, and then divide that by 12 to get the average amount you might need per month. And then as far as how the panel might look, I would say it's a relatively normal curve with a mean kind of in the 30 to 50 age range. Now that can be skewed based on a number of things. There's a somewhat prevalent pricing model where kids are $10 a month if an adult joined. That's not my pricing structure, but many people have that. And that's going to skew you towards having more kids. If you've come from a practice that is mainly the elderly and you're able to recruit from that practice, well, then your practice may be, your direct primary care practice may be skewed towards the older population, and you may have a higher price point because of that. But I would basically use that equation and start with the part of that equation that is most important to you to kind of figure out the other components. But these days, like I said, 600 to 800 is about the average panel size. I would say the average amount collected per patient per month is somewhere in the 50 to 60 range. And most doctors are able to earn, when they have a full panel, 200 to maybe 250,000 pre-tax for their revenue.
Okay, that sounds like a good amount. How many patients do you need to pay your overhead?
It's a really important question, and probably one of the first questions that most doctors that are new to this style of practice ask, and because it really kind of lets you know, hey, you know, when can I relax a little bit and maybe start paying myself, take some time away from the moonlighting job, or stop pulling money out of my savings. And so this is dependent upon two things. What is your overhead? And so what I count as overhead are all costs other than myself. So that's my medical assistant, my rent, all the different types of insurance, the electricity, utilities, all of these things. And like I said, mine's about $10,000 a month. And my average amount collected per patient is $69 per month. So when you take your overhead divided by that average, I would need 145 patients before I've met my overhead. Let's say you were able to get your overhead down to about $4,000 per month, but you still had that $69 average per member per month income. Well, then you only need 58 patients to meet your overhead. So in that situation, by the time you have 58 patients that are signed up to pay you on a monthly basis, you've met your overhead, and you can either start taking time away from the moonlighting job or stop taking money out of your own bank account and you can start paying yourself. And so that's why I think that in part, this is such a powerful model, because you can change that overhead depending on what you want, and you can pretty rapidly get to a point where you don't have to depend on other funds, and you can depend simply on your new direct primary care clinic and spend all of your time focused on providing great care, and that's it. And this is a relatively simple path to finding out where you can break even, and it's mainly dependent upon what your overhead's going to be.
Okay, great. How will you get new patients? Do you have to do direct marketing or networking, or what seems to work best for you?
Yeah, so I'm doing a lecture this summer in Indiana at the DPC Summit, and my topic is working with employers. But in preparation for that, I did call a number of direct primary care doctors around the country and basically take some polls of, you know, how are you accessing new patients? How are you accessing new employer clients? And for the most part, everyone is getting new patients mainly by word of mouth from existing patients. So let's talk about that first, and then I'll talk about a few one-offs of how doctors might get patients. So I think the tipping point of where the word of mouth really starts to propel you is anywhere from about 200 to 300 patients in the panel. And that's going to be dependent upon a number of things. Number one, are you providing great care? And it's much easier in this model to provide great care because I have the time to prepare before they walk in. I have the time to not interrupt them when they're talking. And I have the time to kind of coordinate their care and do the research that's necessary to find them great value outside of my office. So just beyond providing great care, one thing that I would suggest is don't be afraid to ask patients to refer their friends and family to you if they feel like this is a great experience. You could either do that face-to-face, or a lot of times what I'll do is we have a templated message in the communication app, or if I feel like a patient had a really great experience, I'll send that message to them where it's basically already queued up. Hey, if you had a great experience here, would you mind reviewing us? You could either go to X or Y or Z to review us online. And I think most doctors in direct primary care are really increasing their panel size based on their current patients talking to their friends or family. Other than that, you have doctors that are converting from an insurance-based practice to direct primary care. Those doctors will kind of convert anywhere from 5 to 15% of their existing patients, but let's call it an average of 10%. So if you come from a panel size size of 3,000, you may very well bring 300 patients with you. And that kind of puts you past that point of no return where potentially the word of mouth may propel you to the final panel size of 600 to 800. If you're starting from scratch, well, then what I would do is I would try to network and get out in your community and just do things where a lot of community members are going to be. I've personally found it really difficult to get into networking situations where you're talking face-to-face with small business owners. Even those networking events that are supposed to be for small business owners, what I often find is it's people who want to sell things to the small business owner, much like myself, rather than the actual small business owner. So I would say, you know, church, go to just social events where you feel like you may get a broad swath of people from the community and spend some time there. In addition, some people have had some success with being involved in their local chamber of commerce, and I think this is highly dependent upon the size of your city. I'm in Austin, relatively large, and Chamber of Commerce is dominated by very large companies, where even in some kind of local outlying communities, I know that direct primary care doctors have done very well in communities that have, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people there, because it's just much smaller, and I think it's easier to become, be in touch with small business owners in that situation.
Okay. What regulatory entities do you need to interface with and consider?
The two main things are CLIA and OSHA. So CLIA, you'll have to get a license so that you can do some of the CLIA wave testing in your office, rapid strep tests, urinalysis, modern tests, and the like. And then every couple of years, they require some money and potentially some testing so that you can continue with that. And then OSHA as an employer is something else that you need to consider. Kim Korba is a direct primary care doctor. I believe she's up in the Northeast, and she's created a manual alongside her lawyer. They cost, I believe, around $600, and can really cover a lot of these topics that you need to think about. And if you're a member of the Direct Primary Care Alliance, I believe that you get a discount on that, so that may be something to look into.
Okay. As an osteopathic physician, how can a physician do ONT in a DPC practice and get paid for it?
Yeah, so I've had an osteopathic clinic even prior to starting this direct primary care clinic. Because of the style of osteopathy that I practice, which is ligamentous articular strain in parts of the country that's called balanced ligamentous tension, and it takes me a little bit longer than an HVLA treatment, I've never billed insurance for that job. I've always charged for a cash payment. And I continue to do that. I just charge a discount for those people that are members. And so basically the way that I would break it down within my membership is somebody that comes in and says, hey, I've had a short-term headache. I'm just here for help with a headache. I'll do an exam, and if I feel like there's a musculoskeletal component, maybe just have them kind of lay down for a 10-minute treatment right then, and there's no extra charge for that. Or if I feel like there's a kind of a more whole-body treatment or a longer treatment that's necessary, I'll ask them to make an appointment for an hour-long treatment, and for that, I charge them a discounted rate of $160.
Okay. How do you choose a lab to contract with or obtain cash pricing from for imaging?
I would suggest making that decision both on the reliability of the organization, of the lab, and also the pricing that you would get from them. So in my area, we have CPL, which I think is a relatively regional lab, and then we've got Quest and LabCorp. And what I have found with other direct primary care doctors, that they had suggested that Quest or LabCorp may come back in a year, and if they are not seeing the volume of testing that they had expected, they may increase your prices. I'm not saying that that would happen everywhere. It just, I think, happened consistently enough that I tried to veer away from them. I was able to get pricing with CPL that I thought was very adequate and was confident. I mean, they basically said, hey, our prices will not change. and going on 4 years, and they haven't changed. And so I've stuck with them. There's probably other regional-based labs that you might communicate with, or potentially even local hospitals. But I'm, you know, I think my CBC is somewhere just north of $3. Same thing for a CMP. A1C is about $4.50. And in general, you know, direct primary care doctors will mark that up just the slightest bit to basically cover the cost of, you know, accepting credit cards. And then, you know, if somebody doesn't pay a bill or something like that, you know, maybe just to cover that. But we're not, there's no huge markup here. So often people are leaving the office for annual labs for less than $30. And so I would look around and maybe ask your local direct primary care doctors who have some history, who they're using and what they might suggest. But you should be able to contact any of those companies and pretty easily get some numbers and make a decision.
Why is it that you can negotiate such really low rates when insurance companies would charge typically for CBC, you know, $150 for lab processing?
I guess I must just be a really great negotiator. That was tongue-in-cheek if it didn't come across. This is readily apparent for most people, or most doctors that kind of have lived in direct primary care land for a while, which is the prices that we pay for things when we use insurance are altered in a way, because it's basically what they offer is they offer a discount off of some ridiculous number that's not based in reality. And so, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield might sell the largest discounts in the land, and let's say that they charge or they pay 50% off of the bill price. Well, that's still much higher than the actual cost of the lab or the procedure or whatever it may be. And so, you know, the way that this model works is we make our profit and we pay the doctor based on the monthly membership fee. So that's stable. And we know what that's going to look like from month to month and from year to year. And so we don't have to make a profit on anything else. We can basically just pass through the cost, whether it be an x-ray or other testing that you might be able to do in your office. So doctors are offering DEXA or ultrasound or lab tests. So once again, I would just contract with the lab and then basically just pass through the cost to the patient.
Okay, that sounds great. The last question is, we hear from some DPC doctors that they're dispensing medications from their clinics at very low prices. Can you tell me about your experience with that?
I have very limited experience, mainly because of where I live. So in Texas, we're extremely limited on dispensing medications from our office to the point where basically no direct primary care doctor is doing this. Certainly this is something that's on our mind, and we're intent on continuing discussions with the legislature about that. But in many other states, direct primary care doctors are, much like labs, able to just provide these services to their patients and just pass through the cost. And so in other states, doctors will contract with pharmaceutical dispensaries. AndaMeds is a name that I'm familiar with. And the actual wholesale cost for these medications is extremely small. I think like Lexapro is on the order of less than a penny a pill. And then once again, the direct primary care doctor will, you know, have a minimal markup of maybe 10% to cover the cost of the bottle, cover the cost of the printer that you might need to put the label on the bottle, and then just provide value. And so this all kind of comes back to the model, which is we're going to make our profit on the monthly membership, and then we're not really going to make a profit on anything else. And in doing so, we just provide extreme value to people, and pharmaceuticals is just one more area where that applies.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions that we have, and I want to thank you again for all of this information. DPC is very, very interesting, and I think physicians that are moving from fee-for-service to GPC will really be surprised with the ease which they can do that and make the same money or even more money. Listeners can get more information at acofp.org. So thank you very much, Dr. Larson. I know that I've learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. Thank you.